Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 278 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Marcy Kahan describes how a sudden and unexpected mid-career dip led her into playwriting manuals, while maintaining a respectful ambivalence towards the genre. Then, Zoe Marriott explains how character is the North Star that steers her journey through each new fantasy novel, shaping every aspect of setting and story. First, here's Marcy Kahan with The World of Playwriting Manuals.
Can you recommend a good playwriting manual? I am often asked this question by actors, students, and random strangers at drinks parties. And I always hesitate, then stammer politely about the difficulty of acquiring craftsmanship, dramatic instincts, emotional insight from a mere book. Yet, in spite of such skepticism, at last count, there are 20 such volumes on my shelves. Shiny paperbacks with promising titles. The Playwright's Workbook, The Dramatist's Toolkit, Playwriting in Process, New Playwriting Strategies, and my own particular favorite, a workbook aimed at the American high school market, bearing the encouraging declaration, "You can write a play," by Milton E. Polsky. Its delirious exclamation mark cheers me up on gray November mornings. But which manual do I recommend? Well, it's complicated. I began writing plays innocently, spontaneously, confidently, at a very young age, without the need of written instruction. My childhood plays were epic stories of natural disasters. I then shifted to English drawing room comedies, inspired by my reading of Oscar Wilde, Bernard Shaw, and Noel Coward. I had never been in a drawing room, nor had I visited England. This did not inhibit me. I had a natural talent for devising aristocratic epigrams and dramatizing middle-class pomposity. At the age of 12, I came upon a paperback in a Montreal bookshop called Tynan on Theatre. It was a life-changing discovery. Mr. Tynan's engaging reviews of British and American theatre of the 1950s and 1960s transformed me overnight from a naive imitator to a sophisticated and critical analyst of my work. I realized that if my plays were going to match the importance of John Osborne's Look Back in Anger or Bertolt Brecht's The Good Person of Szechuan, if the eloquent and all-knowing Mr. Tynan were to write my plays, I would need expert advice. I hurried to the largest bookshop in Montreal and purchased the only playwriting manual on its shelves, The Art of Dramatic Writing, which bore the reassuringly serious subtitle, Its Basis in the Creative Interpretation of Human Motives. It had been written in 1942 and revised in 1960 by the Hungarian Lajos Egri, who, like me, had written his first three-act drama at the age of 10, and who for many years had been the director of the Egri School of Writing in New York City. Its table of contents was promising. Character growth, the antagonist, point of attack, obligatory scene, entrances and exits. Why are some plays successful? What is art? This was clearly a compendium of dramaturgical gold dust, filled with exactly the kind of practical guidance I most needed. But my euphoria vanished by page 6, when Mr. Egri insisted that every good play must have a well-formulated premise. This premise must be formulated in 3 parts. For example, ill temper leads to isolation. Dishonesty leads to exposure. Craftiness digs its own grave. At the age of 12, I found this advice ludicrous. I still do. Mr. Eggers' insistence that the writer encase her play in a conceptual straitjacket based on banal notions of morality depressed and dismayed me. I tossed it aside and resolved to find some other way to learn about playwriting. I was lucky to be able to leave school age 16. We all did. There was no equivalent to grade 12 or grade 13 in the province of Quebec, which meant that I was spared the ordeal of more academic examinations. Instead, I was eligible to attend a drama school, part of a newly founded junior college in downtown Montreal, where I read plays, acted in plays, and wrote plays, which I then saw performed in front of a live audience. During the years that followed at Oxford University, where I studied Shakespeare and wrote feminist comedies, I never consulted a playwriting manual. There was no need. I had acquired my own method of crafting a scene based on the questions which an actor considers, which had been codified by the Russian director, Konstantin Stanislavski. Where have I come from? What is my objective? What are the strategies that I will use to achieve that objective? Who is thwarting my objective? I then trained in stage movement and physical theater in Paris with the master Lecoq teachers, Monica Panieux and Philippe Gollier. There was no how-to manual for this training. I experienced with my own eyes and body how rhythm and drama can be as important as meaning. I kept notebooks and wrote down memorable comments from actors and directors. Mike Nichols, who began his career directing Neil Simon's early comedies, asserted that there are only three kinds of scene: negotiations, seductions, and fights. A British director observed that my plays were too literary. He quoted the French writer Jean Cocteau, "Prose is Queen Anne's lace. Dramatic dialogue is ship's rigging." A book on storytelling and improvisation by Keith Johnston changed the way I observed and understood human behavior, especially transactions of status. After you've read Keith Johnston, no conversation will ever seem entirely innocent. I settled in London, sold my first three radio plays to the BBC, won the Perrier Award at the Edinburgh Festival with a zany physical comedy, acquired an agent, and had my first screenplay produced by BBC Television. This film was distributed in cinemas by an up-and-coming New York company called Miramax. I was now a professional playwright. My shelves were filled with books on every topic except one: how to write a play. Then one day, and a very unexpected, very somber day it was, I was working on my first Noel Coward espionage adventure for BBC Radio 4. I had reached the middle of the narrative. Noel Coward, who is spying for Britain in wartime New York, knocks on the door of the people he thinks are the good spies. They open the door and ask, "What are you doing here?" Noel Coward looked at me and asked, "What am I doing here?" I didn't know. I had no idea. The play collapsed. Suddenly, after decades of sure-footed prolificity, I had lost the ability to finish a play. After several weeks of inertia and despair, I journeyed to one of the larger London bookshops. I found the shelf of playwriting manuals. I began flipping through them: characters, setting, dialogue. Just as I had feared, there was nothing in these how-to books to rescue my play. Then I saw it, an enigmatic subheading in the middle of a chapter: "Commit to your backstory." What did that mean? I read on. If the playwright establishes a set of expositional circumstances, this textbook explained, it is essential that the writer believes in them and has tested their plausibility. Otherwise, the play might collapse. This was the problem with my espionage adventure. I had invented a glib backstory, but had failed to explore its implications. I needed to revisit every beat, every nuance of the backstory so that the play might go forward. I returned home. I thought hard about the backstory. I made notes. I designed charts. I turned on the computer. There was Noel Coward knocking on the door of the people he thinks are the good spies. They opened the door and asked, "What are you doing here?" This time, Noel Coward was able to reply. It's doubtful I was followed. I had a martini at the Plaza, took a taxi to Battery Park, hopped on a bus up Broadway to Sardi's, ordered a sirloin steak and a baked potato, took two bites of each, chatted to the lunts, ducked out via the kitchen, walked east on Fifth Avenue, and took a taxi up here. After that brief but memorable nervous breakdown, I regarded playwriting manuals with new respect. I also decided it might be a good idea to get out of the house more, perhaps do some teaching. I was hoping to conduct seminars on Shakespeare, Chekhov, the ancient Greeks, but Birkbeck College in Bloomsbury was looking for a playwright to teach playwriting, the nuts and bolts of putting a play together. I was engaged to conduct all-day Saturday seminars on the art of dramatic writing. All-day seminars. I needed a coherent teaching narrative. That is when I began acquiring playwriting manuals. Which ones do I recommend? David Edgar, who founded the UK's first MPhil course on playwriting at Birmingham, and Steve Waters, who currently teaches dramatic writing at the University of East Anglia, have both published stimulating books. Edgar's is called How Plays Work. Waters' book is The Secret Life of Plays. My favorite nuts and bolts guide dates from 1912, William Archer's Playwriting, A Manual of Craftsmanship. Archer is now best remembered as a friend of Bernard Shaw's and an early translator of Ibsen, but he also earned a fortune with his 1921 melodrama, The Green Goddess. His analysis of play construction is compelling, his prose witty and lucid. Another obscure guide that I reread every few years is Walter Kerr's 1956 volume, How Not to Write a Play. Walter Kerr was one of the most prominent New York theater critics during the 50s and 60s, a contemporary of Kenneth Tynan's. He was married to a playwright, Jean Kerr. Their urbane Manhattan life was made into one of my favorite movies, Please Don't Eat the Daisies, starring David Niven and Doris Day. Walter Kerr's How Not to Write a Play contains wonderful advice. A good way to destroy a play is to force it to mean something. Work by touch as long as you can. Be swift to see and slow to identify. He is also very wise about exposition. You need to have your audience demanding it, not resisting it. One final obscure guide that you might find useful is a 1939 volume by Kenneth Thorpe Rowe called Write That Play. Mr. Rowe was Arthur Miller's playwriting teacher at the University of Michigan in 1937. Miller has recorded that Rowe taught him that the theater was not a carousel one jumped into, but an instrument one had to learn to play. Half of the book consists of a careful analysis of Ibsen's A Doll's House, with the text printed on the left-hand side and Mr. Rowe's commentary on the right. Yet in spite of my fascination with their ideas, my attitude toward these analytical volumes remains one of respectful ambivalence. Playwriting manuals are like cookbooks. Each book may contain only three or four recipes that you regularly return to, but imagine how bereft your dinner times would be without these favorite recipes. Over time, each practitioner assembles her own playwriting manual in a collection of notebooks charting the progress of each play, as well as more general notebooks detailing responses to reading and watching plays, plus nuggets of dramaturgical wisdom gathered from everywhere. These notebooks are private, idiosyncratic, and wide-ranging. Over time, with luck, they may result in public, idiosyncratic, and wide-ranging plays.
That was Marcy Kahan, recorded by Gabriel Bedamosi. You can find out more about Marcy on the RLF website. Next, here's Zoe Marriott with Finding the North Star.
Fantasy is a unique genre, but not for the reason that many people assume. There's an idea that fantasy is exemplified by Tolkien, or George R.R. Martin, by dragons, chilly European castles, knights in plate armour and, let's face it, white men on quests of derring do. That it's all about the trappings, about what is generally called world-building. This, to put it mildly, is not the case. It's rather like saying that all crime fiction is about little old ladies solving murders in cosy village settings, or that all novels with a romance element are about haughty rich men and spirited heroines in the Regency era. Fantasy is as diverse as any other genre. In fact, it is perhaps the most diverse genre. World-building is a very important part of that, but it is not the North Star by which all fantasy authors must navigate. If you pick up a novel marked detective or crime, you'll know that someone or many someones are going to die or go missing, or perhaps that something valuable will be stolen. One or more of the characters must solve this mystery and set the world back to its proper order. In any romance novel, a couple will meet, undergo separation through internal or external forces, and eventually be reunited or parted forever. But what if I tell you I'm writing a fantasy novel? The possibilities are infinite. You simply can't know what's in there. An apocalypse? A road trip? Magic? Religion? Grand battles? Or domestic drama? The plot of a fantasy may focus on romance, history, war, on personal transformation, or a detective story of its own. Or none of these. What is unique about fantasy is that if an author applies this label to their work, then the world accepts it as such. And that means you can write nearly anything you want. This is as exhilarating as it is terrifying. I believe it is also the reason that despite its long and noble lineage, dating back as far as humanity's very first stories, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh, the story of the founding of China's first dynasty, Greek and Norse myths, many people scorn the genre. A historical novelist once sniffed at me, "I have no interest in fantasy. When anything is possible, I find everything boring." The writer had forgotten that even though each novel begins with nearly limitless possibilities, any single story within it must take, as its very first task, the definition of limits. This goes for historical novels as well as fantasy. It's always the writer's primary job to discover what their story is truly about. So how do I come up with a setting, with magic, with conflict, and with characters for my fantasy world, where there are so many limitless possibilities confusing and tempting me? For me, all stories are about characters. This isn't the case for every writer, of course. Some are primarily motivated to write by settings, or cultures they wish to invent or explore, by a plot or a central dilemma they wish to play with, or by some detail of history. But for me, writing begins when a few of the myriad of character traits which are always floating around in my head collide in an unexpected way and fusion occurs. A new character flares to life, steps forward and speaks. There is a monster in the forest. I never knew my mother's name. In my dreams, the wolves come for me. The first line that a new character speaks in my head nearly always becomes the first line of the work in progress and eventually the book, although there have been exceptions. This part always feels quite magical to me, and I tend to believe that the price for it is the next part, which is not magical at all. This, returning to my earlier point, is figuring out what the story is actually about. Of course, it will be about my character, in the sense that it will describe the events involving them, but what I actually mean here is something broader. The thesis. There's a notion that themes, messages, theses are bad in fiction. The overarching ideals contained in a story are things for readers to work out. Artists should write what's in their heart and let the world decide later what they actually meant by it. But I find I can't get anywhere with a story, let alone produce a beginning, middle and ending amounting to 100,000 words, unless I have some idea what the point of it is. And there's always the danger that if you don't actually know what you're trying to say, you might say something you didn't mean to. First, I need to understand my protagonist's lie, the fatal flaw within them that will be central to their arc of evolution within the story. Why? Because it will tell me the story's truth, the central idea I need to help my character and my readers understand before the end. This is, you've guessed it, what I mean by thesis. Let's say that the partially developed character who presents themselves to me is dreaming about running from wolves. In their dream, the landscape they flee across is one of ice and snow. The dream is the key to them. They are ragged with fear and weariness. They never settle in one place for long. They have no one. They're searching, but for what, they don't yet know. This character's lie is, I don't belong anywhere, and I don't deserve a family. So the story's thesis must be, you can find a place to belong, and a family, if you have the courage to stand and fight for them. It's a moment of much internal rejoicing for me, because now those infinite possibilities are beginning to flicker and fade in the distance, and I've glimpsed the North Star. The character's life so far has been defined by running away from their fear and their lie. I must take away this character's ability to run. And now is when the glory of fantasy writing really illuminates the heavens of my imagination, because I have the power to create the exact setting which will do this job. I begin rifling through my internal Rolodex of settings that I've loved, and then dive into my collection of non-fiction books on geography and my large pile of BBC documentaries on various interesting settings in the real world. I begin to study geographical features which can be used to build the sorts of settings I require, settings which make it perilous or impossible to run. I settle on hills, forested hillsides with leopards and bears, slopes so steep that in order to be farmed, they must be terraced. Deep gorges with fast-moving rivers at their bottoms, and above, snowy, treacherous mountains. Now my character is going to find it extremely hard to run without falling to their death or tripping over a nasty hazard which may eat them. This part, constructing a landscape, naming rivers, cities, mountains, and nations, is the kind of world-building that many people immediately imagine when they hear fantasy. But this is still all in service of character, and so rather than get too carried away with my imaginary landscapes, I remind myself there needs to be more happening in the book than just a fantasy setting, because you can still run, even at a walk. I need to imagine other external forces which could prevent her, from following her lifetime habit of disappearing at the first sign of trouble or conflict. So I look again at my character. I begin to get an inkling that this heroine is fighting an internal battle between the two sides of her nature, who she really is and who she thinks she is, a battle between her perception of herself as cowardly and unworthy, and the reality that she is brave and kind. I like this theme, a theme of contrasts, opposing sides that constantly seek to destroy each other, like a war, a civil war. Here's where the plot begins to take shape. When my heroine enters this new and unfamiliar landscape, which forces her to slow to a walk for the first time, she will stumble into a civil war. She will be caught between two sides. She can't escape, so she must either pick a side and stand and fight, or watch the people involved be destroyed. My setting and my main character are now taking shape, and I need to begin to imagine and construct the two sides in my civil war, taking care to illustrate points of commonality and divergence between them. I also need to come up with specific plot events that will allow these two sides to clash again and again, nearly dashing my character to pieces between them. But while I'm doing all this, I'm still fleshing out the character, learning more about her, and bringing in more influences to give her depth. As a folklore and fairy tale enthusiast, this means archetypes. And this story seems to draw quite a lot to mind. I think about Cuchulainn and Beowulf, heroes with a dual nature, a charming civilized side and a bestial one. What if my main character's personal struggle was similar to this? What if she was unable to control a berserk rage that was in direct opposition to her true nature? In many versions of Cuchulainn's story, he's torn between two great loves, his wife and a queen of the fairies or a wild warrior maiden. Perhaps my heroine too could be torn between two great loves, one who is grounded in her past and the other who beckons her toward a different future. Now she will be caught in the middle emotionally and physically. But once again, because this is a fantasy, it's possible to go further. And there's a niggling in the back of my mind that tells me I should. Most of the great heroes with dual natures owed some part of that dual nature to the intervention of uncanny forces, fairies or old gods. And as soon as I think this, I realise that in a story about opposing sides, it would add the perfect final layer to make the heroine's soul a battleground between old gods and new. What if her berserker rage came from an ancient god? A dark god of ice and snow, a god of wolves. and in entering the conflict in this new country, the heroine was drawing the attention of a newer god, a goddess of warmth, wisdom, and fire. These gods both want her for their own, and they might rip her apart between them if she doesn't choose. By this point, the setting, situation, relationships, and archetypes are all set to drive my protagonist to her breaking point, forcing her to grow and change, to reject the lie and learn the story's truth. And because she's tangled up with other people as part of that journey, her transformation will change them too. And if a lot of people in the middle of a battle are changed, then the course of the fight will be. And when the course of the civil war is changed, so is the entire country. When other people read this book, they may say that it's about racial oppression, war, courage, a love triangle, or a berserker. And it is. But it is the North Star, the notion of a character who must be taught to stop running, to stand and fight, in order to find family and a place to belong, which has guided me faithfully to a place where at last I'm ready to begin writing. This is how fantasy works for me. I discover or am discovered by a character, and then construct everything around my understanding of the journey they need to undergo. But I believe that this process works no matter what motivates you to begin work. Simply discover your North Star, the one thing you are utterly invested in exploring, whether that is a character, a dilemma, a plot twist, a world, or a culture, and use that to navigate through all the limitless possibilities presented to you by your imagination.
That was Zoe Marriott, recorded by Amanda Whittington. You can find out more about Zoe on her website at www.zoemarriott.com. That's Marriott with two R's and two T's. And that concludes episode 278, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 279, Susan Fletcher speaks with Carolyn Sanderson about choosing her settings, writing outdoors, and her love of nature. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.